Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Memoirs by athletes are often co-written by beat writers or sports columnists from their local papers where they played during their careers. Some names that come up time and again include Phil Pepe, Lonnie Wheeler, Wayne Coffey, and Marty Appel. But when Reggie Jackson decided to do his latest memoir, he called not on one of those veterans, but on Kevin Baker, who's known mostly for his work in historical fiction. Baker's first novel, Sometimes You See It Coming, came out some 20 years ago. His latest, The Big Crowd, just this year, so he's been very busy. Fortunately, he had some time to talk about his work with the Baseball Bookshelf.
Kevin Baker, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
Well, congratulations. You've been very busy this year. This is two books coming out the same year, Becoming Mr. October and The Big Crowd.
Yeah, this has been a new one for me, two books out in the same season, one a novel and one a memoir.
And I wanted to mention a happy anniversary because this is the 20th anniversary of your first novel.
Yes, thanks for remembering that. Yeah, that was Sometimes You See It Coming, a baseball novel, so kind of a combination of what I'm doing this year.
Now, would it be fair to say that as a writer you're mostly known for your fiction?
Sure, and that's what I consider myself mainly to be, as a novelist. But I also do, I've done some history and some journalism, and plan to do more of both.
And in your fiction, would it be fair to say that most of the novels are historical novels?
Yes, yeah, that's including The Big Crowd, which is set just before and just after the war in New York City.
So I imagine there's a lot of research that goes into these things.
Yeah, quite a bit. I mean, on some of these, really, the research has been the main thing, the longest part of the work. You know, the first few historical novels I wrote took about 3 years apiece, and you know, at least half of that was research.
Now, doing the Becoming Mr. October was a real departure then.
Yeah.
So, how did you come to that project?
Well, that was you know, it's doing this as told to memoir with Reggie Jackson about his first couple years in New York, and both Reggie's agent David Black and our editor Bill Thomas over at Doubleday really were looking for somebody to do something like the great job that T.J. Morringer did with Agassi. You know, the idea was to get somebody who wasn't a beat baseball writer, but somebody a little more from kind of a different literary tradition.
Because I was going to say that most of the books of these types are written by beat writers.
Yeah, and you know they often do an outstanding job, but you know, I my very first professional writing job was as a high school sports beat writer back when I was 13 years old. But they wanted to do something different, and you know, because I think the Agassi book worked so incredibly well, and yeah, he got, you know, I'm not somebody who particularly has much interest in tennis, but I was fascinated reading it, and the idea was to, you know, try to get that kind of angle on Mr. Jackson and see how it worked.
But again, this is in a sense not your book; it's his book. So what in that
Very
regard,
much.
What do you bring to the table?
Well, I hope I brought like a wider perspective about society as a whole, and I think that's one thing he was interested in getting to. Yeah, it was very much his book. I mean, it was all done on interviews with him, and he went over every single word of it twice. After we had done in the editing process. What I think we were both trying for is to get some idea of him as really one of the first black superstars in this era. I mean, granted, he didn't come to New York till like 30 years after Jackie Robinson, but there still had been very few superstars of color in New York in that time.
Now, when you say this era, yeah. Do you mean the free agency era?
Yes. Yeah, and he was really the star. You know, you have people like Catfish Hunter and Andy Messersmith before him, but he was really the first pick in what became organized free agency. When they started in 1977, they had the before the 77 season, when they had the free agent draft, and it was a draft then. Teams were allowed to pick 10 players, and they went in order. He was the first guy picked, drew as much attention as anyone then, and ended up coming to New York, where he was really the first black superstar since Willie Mays left town. 20 years before. I mean, you had those great Knicks teams with their stars, but basketball at that point wasn't nearly what baseball was. And you really hadn't had a big black star in pretty much anything else in the city.
One of the things that stood out to me as I read the book was I had never considered how much the early free agents were resented by the more established veterans who were on the downside of their career. And
yeah.
They no longer look forward to earning that kind of money anymore.
Right. I mean, nobody kind of quite got how free agency was going to work, too. The idea that you you would get your turn, and then you could ask to sign for more. They were all feeling like, wow, he got this sort of money. Well, and it was, in present terms, it's such a tiny amount of money compared
right.
to what people get. But
utility outfielder salary. Now.
Yeah, I think he was getting what's below, I think, the minimum salary now in baseball. But they felt, they didn't quite get that they would get their chance. They felt like everything should be assessed, every player should be assessed against every other player every year. And they, they also felt, particularly on the Yankees, they had won the pennant. So, why should this guy get such a big salary coming in here? And in fact, they all got, because they complained loud and long about it, they really all got raises from George Steinbrenner
yes.
because Reggie came in. But it didn't keep them from complaining about it still and feeling it was still unfair.
Now, you're obviously a baseball fan. Were you a Reggie yeah. Jackson fan before this?
Oh, yeah. And I was, coincidentally, I was in the park for a lot of his big Yankee moments. I still have the scorecards I have from his first game as a Yankee in 1977, the home opener, and from the Reggie Bar game in 1978, which is an amazing moment.
But do you have any Reggie bars?
Yeah. I don't. I should have saved the Reggie Bar I got that day at the stadium. That was quite amazing. I've never seen anything like that in baseball, and I don't know if we ever will see anything again. I mean, that was this kind of spontaneous tribute where everybody hurled these bars down onto the field was like something out of bullfighting, for lack of a better example. I don't, and it was the fact that it wasn't planned, that people just did it, I think was terrific and really brings across some of the excitement of those days.
Now, coming in as someone who is familiar with Jackson's work, how does that play into your, shall we say, objectivity in doing this project?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is a memoir from his point of view, so the objectivity is limited. I mean, basically, that was one of the ideas, was he really wanted to tell his part of the story. He felt that had not been got across well enough before.
But he's had several books before.
Yeah, yeah. But he really felt that this was sort of, the way things had gone with some of these things had not really told the whole story of what he went through in New York.
And I think he said he based this on the way he was portrayed in the film version, the TV film version of Ladies and Gentlemen, The Bronx is Burning.
Yes, yeah. And that was, he didn't feel that was fair to him. And it's funny when you look at Reggie back in those days now, all the controversy that revolved around him. I mean, yeah, there were the different things he said or was accused of saying. But really, this wasn't somebody who was getting, into fights in strip clubs. This wasn't somebody who was ever caught, ever did any juicing or illegal drugs or anything. He was an amazing straight arrow compared to so many professional athletes today. And it's interesting to see that nonetheless made him so controversial.
And we're talking with Kevin Baker, who co-wrote Reggie Jackson's latest autobiography, Becoming Mr. October. What is the process when you work with him? Do you sit down face to face? Is he speaking to a tape recorder and send you the tapes and you edit them and put them into, you know, literature? How does that work?
Yeah. All of the original interviews were face to face with a tape recorder, and then some of the editing we did over the phone. But you know, some of that was also face to face. So it was very much a personal process like that.
When he would bring up a certain issue, was there anything in your mind that said, "Gee, maybe you shouldn't say this," or do you think like,
no,
or
no,
that's not your job? Actually, I suppose it's just letting.
Yeah.
Him, even if he's wrong, you got to let him talk.
Right. I very much wanted it to be his story, and I think that's what it succeeded as. You know, if anything, he was more worried about offending people, particularly, people with the Yankees now and all. For the most part, it's, he has very few big fights with anybody. You know, he still is upset about how he was treated by some of the press and by people like Billy Martin. But, he says a lot of nice things about a lot of people, too. But I wanted him to bring out everything. And I thought some of the stuff was just fascinating, about how, being from the generation he was, these were often still the really early black players in the game. So he did not get drafted by the Mets because of the fact that the Mets said he was, thought he was dating a white woman was their thing, And in fact, he was dating this Hispanic woman who became his wife, this was in Reggie himself is half Hispanic. It was ridiculous, but that's the ridiculous sort of thing you get into when you base your decisions on color. But that was fascinating. And then, these early players, at one point with all the A's players who were black, they're having to stay in this former military barrack in Waycross, Georgia, because they're worried the atmosphere outside is going to be too hostile to them. Going through this sort of thing is just remarkable, I find.
And that was the topic of another book that came out this year by Larry Colton about the A's in the early to mid-60s and how they played in Birmingham, I believe, and the problems they had there between the integrated team and the town.
Yeah, and he went through that because as you know, the Bull Connor had basically canceled organized baseball in Birmingham rather than let blacks and whites play together in the town, and they had just come back, and Charlie Finley, who was from Birmingham originally, was very anxious to have a team down there, and Reggie was very apprehensive about playing there, and rightly so. He would get all this thing, it's just hard finding a place to live. I mean, the team kind of left him to do that, and for a while he'd be down there, and in between apartments, he would stay at his friend Joe Rudy's place. And Joe Rudy's wife would have to get on the phone to the landlord and threaten legal action because the landlord's always trying to throw him out, being a black man. Then later he was staying in this kind of rundown hotel, the Bankhead Hotel. And, he was saying there was this young blonde, I think daughter or something of the owner who was hanging around, that he was afraid of, if he got involved with her anyway, there'd be a big racial incident. I mean, it was a really hairy time in many ways, and it's kind of forgotten that people, like Reggie came up through that.
Now you say it's forgotten. I wonder, and I'm guessing you don't have any part in the marketing aspects, but I wonder, a book like this, for whom is it written? Is it written for young fans today? Is it written for fans who followed the Yankees and Jackson in those days? And in that, a lot of young people today don't realize, you're only talking about 40, less than 50 years ago when these were considerations.
Yeah, I would hope it would be for both. I mean, I would hope it would be for young fans today to think, this is how it was. I mean, I know I'm always fascinated in the baseball that I didn't see, as a fan. And I would hope that fans of that time, too, who remember that well, will find new things in it. I mean, I was fascinated, for instance, that he was telling me that that George Steinbrenner used to call up his father, who at the time was a tailor and dry cleaner outside of Philadelphia, and say, Mr. Jackson, Reggie's letting Billy Martin get into his head. You got to come up here and talk to me about it. He's not hitting like he should. And his father would call up Reggie and say, you know, I don't have time to go up there and talk to George Steinbrenner. You come down here after the game. Come on down here to Trenton, where his outside Trenton, where his brother was living at the time. We'll get the family together and we'll talk about this. And he would go down there and talk to his family. And, you know, and I was saying, like, I was amazed by this. And I was saying, you know, did you find it condescending at all to have this white man who was your boss call up your daddy? And he was saying no. He felt it was just he felt he wasn't really a man yet, and it was great to have somebody who cared that much. And he really found great sustenance from his family. He'd go down there, and his father would tell him, you know, don't worry about Billy Martin. Your job is to hit the ball. Just concentrate on that ball. And he would. You know.
That kind of brings to mind a relationship between Mickey Mantle and his father.
Yes, yeah, very much, kind of that sort of thing. And again, there was this sort of, you know, I mean, I think Reggie went through more of a little rebellion about his father. But of course, his father lived much longer to see him play, which was nice. And in fact, apparently he used to hand out cards saying, he had cards made up for himself saying, you know, Martinez Jackson, father of Reggie Jackson, you know, so.
Let's talk a minute about your novel, Sometimes You See It
sure.
Coming.
Yeah.
You base it on an actual team. You base it on the Mets. Why did you do that instead of making up a team?
You know, I wanted to have a certain, you know, kind of patina of realism there. Although the player in question on the Mets wins the batting title, which is pretty unrealistic. Yes, I wanted to, you know, kind of put it on a major league team. It's basically sort of a story of a figure who's kind of a Ty Cobb figure. With a little Ted Williams and Roberto Clemente thrown in, but moved to the present day, or what was the present day 20 years ago. You know, this player who's this kind of hard, almost hostile, inscrutable player, and what happens to him as he goes through a season. And it's because of this whole thing in his background, which Ty Cobb had, where Cobb's mother had mistaken quote unquote his father for a prowler and shot him with the family shotgun. And
the family shotgun, it's like such an heirloom. Yeah.
Yeah, basically in Georgia, you know.
And there are characters in that book that remind some people of Billy Martin and George Steinbrenner.
Yeah, and quite deliberately. And
so why didn't you make them the Yankees?
I mean, I think probably at the time the Mets were a much more interesting team when I was first writing on that. So, there was also the player, the owner was kind of based very much too, actually more than Steinbrenner, on old M. Donald Grant, the owner of the Mets, who drove that franchise into the ground. That's the thing. Yeah, Billy Martin is, an amazing how much support he had. You know, I don't think he'd be allowed near a major league team today. You know, the stories of coming, of showing up 10 minutes before the game, you know, in the bag were incredible. But, you know, at the other hand, too, he was going through, in 1977, he was going through this particularly horrible thing where his long estranged daughter had been picked up as a drug mule in Colombia and was being held in prison. And he was constantly getting letters saying, if you send us more money, she'll get out or she'll be treated better, things like this, you know. So it was a pretty unbearable time for him, apart from his usual demons.
Now, you also wrote the foreword for an edition of The Natural. How did that come about?
Yeah, that was, I was asked to do it and was happy to. I mean, that's a terrific book. Piece of, I was going to say baseball writing, but it's a terrific piece of writing, period.
That's quite an honor.
Element thing. Yes, it was very much an honor. And, it's interesting, you know, to read through that again. I mean, it's so much darker than the movie they converted it into. And again, based on a real, you know, this is the amazing thing with baseball. You can't make this stuff up, you know, based on a real incident, the shooting of, I think it was Eddie Wakis, by a female fan that inspired that. It's really, the stories are amazing. I'm working right now on a history of New York City baseball for Pantheon that I hope to have done fairly shortly. And
nonfiction?
You know, yes, nonfiction. Okay. And it just the real life stories are incredible. You know, all these. I mean, the hard part of it is trying to limit it because there's just so much that went on with baseball in New York and baseball in general.
And when is that scheduled for release?
Well, I'm hoping to get it done in the next few months, and so it'll probably be scheduled, you know, whatever the next spring is when we have it ready. So I would say probably something like spring of 2015, something like that.
So having had the experience of writing novels and writing nonfiction history and as Told To project, do you think you would do another As Told To project, or how stressful was this?
Yeah, I mean, possibly. It would really depend on the individual and on the story they had to tell. But I wouldn't necessarily rule it out. I mean, it's really interesting to do it. And you know, Reggie is somebody who is very very interesting. I mean, he's very he's really somebody who could have made his living potentially as a in the writing business. I think he was a very good editor. He'll go through and he'll say, like, you know, let's take all this garbage out here, or I'll take all this stuff out here, you know, when he feels something's too cluttered.
How long did you work with him on this?
Gosh, it was about 3 years altogether.
Really?
Yeah, it was hard. It was hard. You know, he has lots of other commitments, so it was hard pinning him down at times to sit down and talk. He goes and consults for the Yankees and goes around to their teams, and he has a number of business ventures going. So, we did it catch as catch can. I went out there to his place in Carmel once, and down to Florida once. Mostly, when he was in New York, we would catch up and do it in one of the hotels he's in.
So all in all, it was a pleasant experience working with him?
Oh, yeah, it was, and really, just really tremendously interesting. And I hope the book is as interesting as well.
Because I wonder, you say he was so careful in editing. I wonder if the experience he had with that sport magazine business,
very much.
Turns a drink, made him think, I got to pay a lot more attention to these things in the future.
Yeah, very much. And he's very suspicious of sports writers in general. And that whole piece was particularly, with old Robert Ward there, I was trying to get Robert Ward to talk about that with him, and he wouldn't do it unless we were on. He said he wanted me to get him, he and Reggie on ESPN, and then he'd talk about it. I said, well, if I could do that, but
that's a big strange business,
that
story.
Yeah.
Either Jackson said it or he didn't, and
right.
Like the line about he had first signed Brendan Martin, once born liar, once convicted. Is not being forthcoming here.
Yeah, in fact, he had an interesting line about that line, too. Reggie was saying that the one's born liar, the other's convicted. He was saying that originally that was what players on the Yankees were saying about Steinbrenner and Martin in the spring training of 78, and Martin stole that line from there. The Ward thing, Reggie is saying that he was partly fed the line by Ward. He says the whole, when he says, are you saying you're the straw that stirs the drink? He claims that he was saying, well, if you want to say that, but I wasn't. It's interesting because it is hard to picture Reggie saying that Munson can only stir it bad. I mean, even if he's being boastful about his role, why would he say that about Munson? That just seems strange, and Ward has a whole scenario in which he does this because he's partly been humiliated by Whitey Ford and Mickey Mantle, if Reggie denies that, and so, I don't think Ward has a tape of it, which
would
be interesting.
I'd love to see his notes or hear the original tape, or something that proves that this is exactly what happened.
And, it's you get a little suspicious of Ward's baseball acumen when he has some line in that article about how Reggie is this like lone gunslinger who's not with these teams and Reggie had a tremendously fun time as all those guys had on the A's just before that. He was not somebody who was this outsider going from team to team or something. That's not how it worked. But who knows exactly what was said. It's he would like to have been a fly on the wall at the time.
Exactly. And we've been talking with Kevin Baker, who with Reggie Jackson worked on Jackson's latest memoir, Becoming Mr. October. Kevin, thanks very much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Kevin Baker talking about his work on Reggie Jackson's latest memoir, Becoming Mr. October. Well, thanks for listening. Tune in again soon. We hope to be doing these more often. And don't forget, it's holiday time, and nothing makes a better baseball book gift than 501 Baseball Books Fans Must Read Before They Die, available at Amazon.com and hopefully your local bookstore. Thanks again, everybody. See you soon.